Alright, this is mine.
Yes, in your chart, as I was looking at the relationships between among price, income, and non-economic factors, especially as they changed towards the end from 78 to 2008, what was striking to me was that, and this is the question is whether you consider this, was that the context, the macro context for this, had two very important elements which would really influence things. One is that it was a period of general material prosperity, economic expansion, and the other, and maybe just as important, it was the rise of cheap imports from China. And if that effect, those two effects together, changed the significance of these different expenditure categories compared to the earlier period. And I was just wondering whether that sort of more macro context was one that you were able to look at, and if not, do you think, in what way might it have some significance?
Well, in terms of looking in macro level, we have just looked at micro levels on, for households, so we have not included any macro sort of things in the model. The price effect of cheaper imports, they will show themselves in the price effects, I believe. For instance, in terms of clothing, actually, we've seen that price has a very high contribution to positive changes in expenditure. So, for instance, one of the reasons could be like because we have like some of these cheap imports, as you say, so people tend to use even more and spend more. So that's why price, I think, has a very high contribution in clothing specifically. We have included some of dummy variables in the model in case that there is any structural change in some of the years in the whole model, but we have not looked at any macro things in the model really. It's just in the household level.
Could I just add though that the sort of general expectation and sort of wealth effects might come be captured in the non-economic factors. The general prosperity should come through the income effect and the prices should come through the prices, but if there is some sort of more general feeling of you know, times are good, they're going to remain good for a long time, and therefore change the sort of structural play, that might come through the non-economic factors.
And that would have an influence on the conclusion with regard to, say, the role of taxes, that if the context has changed, whether because China's not so cheap or we're all not feeling so rich, then perhaps the conclusion with regard to the value of using taxation might be different.
Second row on that first row on front of that.
This might sound stupid, but what are exogenous and non-economic factors?
Well, as I mentioned, exogenous non-economic factors are things that maybe we are not aware of, but we know that other than income and price, but definitely there are some other factors that may affect our expenditure. But an example of that is, for instance, consumer taste and preferences and technology and things like that. And we have just considered these all as a whole, as opposed to income and price.
Well, I wanted to see that a bit more, because Angela and Tim distinguish between luxury and locking as a way of sort of thinking about non-economic factors, perhaps. Partly that's consumer tastes and preferences. But partly lock-in is whether people live in a country or in a big house, things which can't be changed very quickly and which would shape non-economic factors. Can you say anything about the balance between those two aspects of non-economic?
Well, here we have just looked at non-economic factors as a whole, so we have not disaggregated anything to talk about the components within non-economic factors and the effect of each of these two. So it's like an average of all these things, because our aim here was just to look at non-economic factors as a whole, as opposed to economic factors.
Do you have enough data available to segment the data and run it past different demographic groups?
Well, we haven't done that for demographic groups. I'm not sure if we have this data. Do you know if we, Angela, do you have this data?
Okay, If you want 1 year at a time, we can do it by different demographic groups, by income deciles or by socioeconomic groups like ACORN groups or whatever. Mona's using quarterly time series data, and that they don't provide in an easy format by different socio-demographic groups. It could be done, but it'd be a lot of hard work. So yes, in theory.
Back there, I wonder if I could ask a perhaps deliberately naive question about causality. I can see how price might influence consumer expenditure. That's kind of classic microeconomics. But is it possible that in fact expenditure could be driving the non-economic exogenous factors we talked about rather than the other way around?
Well, I think this is something that, as you say, from causality, we have to examine that. So I've not done work on that, really. But that is like a test that we should do between price and expenditure and the relation of expenditure and price to test that, whether it works that way or not.
Have you got any idea why gas and electricity are in different categories? One is heavily influenced, I think it was by income, and the other by electricity by income and gas by non-economic factors.
Well, because gas is mainly used for space heating.
So it will be temperature then?
Temperature has effects on that,
and
definitely, and that was significant. Also people, they don't look at their income if they really need the space heating. Income is not as dominant as, say, for instance, in electricity case. Is the reason that the need to use gas and the need to use expenditure for different reasons really at home. Temperature is actually a significant factor.
The question's more widely.
Right, Tony Bobby on the panel.
So I had some leftover question about serious leisure. One of the most serious leisure pursuits, well, one of the most seriously concerning leisure pursuits that I think about is shopping as a leisure activity. I mean, consuming, you're not actually necessarily buying the thing all the time, but there are cultural things at play there. The department store was one of the first places where women could go without a chaperone, and there are kind of cultural reasons why hanging out in shopping centres is important to our culture.
Yeah.
But the practice of shopping as a leisure activity is quite a worrying thought for those of us looking towards leisure as a solution for how we should use our time more sustainably. I was wondering if you'd had any thoughts on that.
It's a good point, and I think there's a lot of interplay between different factors there, which I would say I'm not on top of all of them, given the sample. But a lot of the concern that runs around leisure in general is this notion that we're going to work, we're coming home, we're watching TV, you know, we're consuming the adverts on the TV, we're going out shopping at the weekend and buying the things that we're seeing, and we've got into this kind of work spend cycle throughout that, of which then that becomes one of those points as to why these sort of serious leisure practices might give another way of living, another set of values away from being caught up in that kind of consumer cycle. And so I think in that respect, yes, in terms of giving more to lives and more meaningful lives, that's important. But I guess what we've also tried to do then when they're looking at the serious leisure practices is to say that actually consumption largely happens inside practices, inside things that we do as well. So a lot of the consumption that we see comes from going and doing things and wanting to buy the goods that enable us to do it. So, so you wouldn't sort of stop all of consumption through having other leisure practices there, as long as you've got the income, because people's money would sort of go somewhere. But you might reduce it, but it would certainly maybe give us more values which are outside of just kind of, you know, working and consuming, because there are other things going on, which isn't probably as clear an answer as you would hope for, because I don't really have the figures to be able to say. But yeah, that's why there's a lot of debate around how we spend our time and what we do with our time and what we do with our leisure.
I'll just add to that in the carbon footprinting work I've done, I did look at travel for shopping, and I can't for the life of me remember what part of the how much of the footprint of travel makes out shopping. But there's two bits of the culture of shopping as an activity. One is going to the shops and hanging out at the shops and not actually buying anything. And that is where your travel emissions come into it, as well, of course, as the whole, you know, infrastructure of the retail park or whatever that you've gone to look at. But, you know, you can divide it down in different ways. So I just thought I'd add that.
And I think it would be quite interesting, with the music industry, one of the things that you're seeing is with artists not making money from purchasing music or from people, you know, buying tickets, they're increasingly looking for branding relationships and partnerships. And then, again, their target market tends to be younger people that might be more captured into these activities of being shopping. So then it becomes quite interesting but also challenging for musicians in terms of their role modelling around sustainable lifestyles. They could do everything, greening tours, greening festivals, but then they seek a partnership where you've got to have the latest outfit, and it becomes very fraught. So it's again that leadership coming from within the arts.
A question for Angela. Carbon footprinting is very policy dependent. I mean, some people would say that we've got a shorter time than others, and particularly the valuation of things like methane and black carbon are different, would be different for Ramanathan than others.
Different for who?
Ramanathan. He's a guy that's very keen on, a climate scientist that's very keen on cooling the earth as quickly as we can to avoid feedbacks, while others say, let's not bother about that, it's carbon dioxide we've got to really worry about. And there's a difference of between the 21 that Kyoto says to methane and I would think he would say 105. So that's five times as much, and it rebalances things. Do you just go for things like PAS 2060 or for your carbon footprinting? Or
okay, the carbon footprinting I've done is some of the work was on carbon dioxide only. Latterly, I've been doing greenhouse gas emissions when the emissions due to food increase a lot. We should, of course, be taking account of a lot more environmental stresses like water use, land use, etc. And the environmental input-output model that I use can be extended to these other environmental impacts, depending on the data availability. And yes, sometimes these things are in conflict, and the numbers are contested. Like you say, you know, what is the value of global warming potential for methane? You can argue different things. I've done some sensitivity work on aviation emissions, etc. And yes, you're absolutely right. We could be looking at different environmental impacts.
You used 21 at the moment,
presumably. No, I used 6 greenhouse gas emissions.
No, I mean 21.
Methane. Yeah. I've just taken the normal values. Yeah.
Can I take a last question from Prashant? And then
I'm Prashant today. I've got a question about the music and the serious leisure. Both of you sort of drew attention to the fact that quite a large part of the emissions have to do with transport. I was wondering if what your thoughts were about some of the kind of virtualization of both, you know, gaming, sort of music and leisure. And I've watched over my lifetime where I used to sort of play real games, go to real gigs, and my children now sort of flipped over to vinyl to MP3, and now they're essentially working in clouds, you know, with downloads in virtual space. So what's the relative impact of that, both of gaming and for music appreciation?
I certainly know from Tim Jackson's work with Eleni
Papathassanopoulos,
that actually they kind of have the rise of electronic goods in leisure has been one of the key reasons why carbon emissions, well, fossil fuel demands, as they worked on, has risen. So obviously they would say it's one of the big three factors in there. What its relationship is between travel, I couldn't say personally. One of the things that we do see in leisure is this notion of multitasking things that are going on, and so that happens a lot around some of the electronic stuff where people are sitting at home and they've got their TV on and they've got the music on and they're playing a game at the same time or they're online, and so we start to see things that get added up, and actually we have people in our sample talk about, I don't know what I'm doing sometimes I've got so many different electronic things going on, giving me different messages, I'm really sure what I'm focused on, and so you can get those impacts from there. I mean, are you talking about in terms of being able to virtually travel the world
today,
rather than...
Pushing out of UK.
What, you know,
to actually push on it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, two things. One, it's seen as being driving a sense of cosmopolitanism in terms of being able to see more of the world virtually, which gives you more of a sense of I want to go there, not necessarily through gaming, but through the internet. It's like, you know, it increases travel at a kind of virtual level, but makes a sense of awareness, which makes us want to go to more places. So that's seen as being an increase in cosmopolitanism. In terms of does it reduce travel and our need to travel, I have nothing on that, I'm afraid.
I think what's interesting is the digital, like the music industry is just starting to grapple, we're starting to work with them on their digital footprint, and I think what's interesting is where the boundaries get drawn, because actually the creative industries feel they've got very little impact on the Apples, all the digital devices, even though they're one of the main content providers into that, and there's some really interesting discussions going on. But in conversations I'm with the arts, they're very interested in how these digital platforms are going to create new experiences. So again, it's going to be engaging with the producers, the artistic producers, to help them understand, like, once you've created that content, what is the life of that content? Because actually, if you have 10,000 tracks sitting on your hard drive or on Spotify, and what that footprint is so different to a CD. But I think in terms of the live experience, I think that will remain and perpetuate. People love that kind of collective lifestyle. So I think you're going to see it going parallel, because your kids will probably still want to go to festivals and they'll want these crazy online concerts as well.
Okay, so we've got a lot there, Christy. I don't really make a lot here. Thank you very much for speaking.